Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Your Honor.
It's good to see you. We'll begin with our first case this morning, which is USA Gymnastics versus Liberty Insurance. Mr. Schiller.
Good morning, members of the panel. My name is Ronald Schiller, and I represent Liberty Insurance, which I'll also be referring to as LIU or Liberty. The panel has our arguments. I would like to, with the permission of the panel, focus on three arguments today address the other two arguments as the panel deems appropriate with questions or if time permits. The three arguments I intend to focus on are the conduct exclusion argument, whether or not the investigations constitute a claim and therefore are covered, and the year of claim or prior knowledge, they overlap argument. And to be clear, that means there are two other major categories of arguments here, the bodily injury exclusion argument and the EPL or employment practices liability sublimit of $250,000. I can cover them if the panel would like me to, but given the time permitted, I wanted to focus instead on the conduct exclusion, the investigations issue, and the year of claim issue.
Mr. Schiller, before you launch into the merits, could you tell us when you began complying and making payments, complying with the court's order?
Your Honor, we have always been making certain payments, and that is we've been making payments for the defense of the personal injury suits.
When did you start making payments to comply with the order you're appealing here?
Recently, Your Honor, the bankruptcy court entered an order fixing the amount due, and we have already made payments pursuant to that order. In other words, there were further proceedings, Your Honor.
How recent was that?
Oh, in the last, I want to say, 6 weeks. And before that, Your Honor, we did not yet have an order setting forth the amount because, as the panel knows, the bankruptcy court and Judge Young in the district court had not set forth an amount, but had entered an order that we were required to make payments and set aside for a future proceeding an enforcement of that order to determine the amount of payments. That order, which is currently subject to objections that were filed in the district court and USA Gymnastics has opposed it, that order was only entered, I want to say, 4 weeks ago, and pursuant to that order, Your Honor, we've made subsequent payments. Besides that, we have been paying part of EPIC, which is a vendor's bills. There's a disagreement about whether we're required to pay 4 or 5% a share among all of the insurers or more. And we've also been paying defense of the Nassar personal injury suits. But the recent order, we have been making payments on, Your Honor. Now, if I could go to the conduct exclusion, if nobody else has questions. Okay. One thing to be clear about is, I know the panel knows this, but this is not a GL or comprehensive general liability policy, and all of the other policies that USA Gymnastics is suing on are GL. This is different. This is a D&O, or directors and officers, or executive professional liability policy, and as a result, this is a claims-made policy that has a much narrower duty to indemnify and a defined duty to defend. Some of the exclusions and issues I'm going to be raising with the panel, if this panel reverses, then judgment should be entered de novo in favor of LIU. Other issues I'm going to raise would result in either a partial reversal or a remand, so that not all issues would result in a total reversal. The conduct exclusion is one which, if the court agrees with LIU, results in a reversal. It's de novo review. It reverses application of this particular D&O policy to the USA Gymnastics claim as a whole. The conduct exclusion, again, on a claims-made policy, provides this policy does not apply to any claim against any insured based upon arising from or in any way related to any deliberately dishonest, malicious, or fraudulent act or omission, or any willful violation of law by any insured. Now, that language, first of all, is the claim exclusion that starts with the prefatory language, this policy does not apply to. And what that language means is that the policy does not apply at all with respect to either defense or indemnity. And there are other provisions in this policy, not under Section 4 claim exclusions, but for example, under Section 6.2, which is a loss exclusion, which distinguishes between a covered loss or indemnification and defense, and says that under certain circumstances, for example, in 6.2, while a loss may not be covered by this policy, defense would be. Not true with the claim exclusions. It's a very broad exclusion. This policy does not apply, so it reaches defense and indemnity, and it applies to any claim against any insured in any way relating to any deliberately dishonest, malicious, or fraudulent act, or any willful violation of law by any insured. Now, that language is different than any Indiana case cited by USA Gymnastics to the panel. No case involves the broad this policy does not apply to or any claim against any insured. And in fact, the word any insured is reinforced repeatedly in this language in a way.
Miller, could I ask you, you said that if we agree with you on this issue, we should reverse entirely. Would it be possible to agree with you about, in essence, the first half of the clause of the exclusion, but to say that the only final adjudications concern the 10 young women where Dr. Nasser was actually convicted for crimes against them?
Would it be possible to parse the language and say that the adjudication which is required here does not bar as to any person for everything? Possible, yes, not supported by the language we respectfully submit, Your Honor. And the reason for that is that the acts that are at issue here are acts of Larry Nasser.
Well, and they're similar. Consider, for example, how such a clause might apply, let's say, to an insured business that has an employee who has 4 accidents, traffic accidents, driving company vehicles over the course of a year. The employee is drunk in each one of them. Would all of those have to be treated as related, as you see it, for this purpose, particularly if he's convicted of only one?
Well, Your Honor, that's not, I don't think all of them would have to be treated as related. However, Your Honor, that's not our facts. Our undisputed facts are A, that Larry Nasser was convicted of willful and intentional conduct. Secondly, he had a sentencing hearing with some 200 people who testified. Third, the convictions involved both Michigan State and non-Michigan State, that is USAG athletes. Next, USAG itself says these are related claims and interrelated wrongful acts. The only way it can connect all of the investigations, which I'm going to get to Larry Nasser's conduct, is to say that these acts of depravity, these acts of sexual acts that were unlawful and for which he was convicted and sentenced to a couple hundred years in prison with a couple hundred people testifying against him, they have said that these acts connect everything. They have to say that because otherwise all of the investigations that they're seeking coverage against from LIU, Liberty, and only Liberty on, unless they go to a subsequent D&O carrier because Your Honor rules against them, the only way they can connect them is to say that these acts by Larry Nasser are related and are interrelated wrongful acts. And to be clear, claim-
Miller, before you continue on, I do have a question about this particular language, which everyone is referring to as an intentional acts exclusion. But the language is particular to the context here, which is a DNO policy and an EPL and the EPL insurance context. And the cases mostly cover intentional acts exclusions in CGL. And so my question is this language common in D&O insurance policies, or is this unique to your company, your client?
It is not uncommon in D&O policies, meaning that D&O policies, as a matter of practice, frequently bar coverage in any way relating to deliberately dishonest, malicious, or fraudulent acts or willful violation of law. And to be clear, Your Honor, it's not deliberately or fraudulent causes of action. In other words, for a financial fraudulent crime, it's an act. It's a willful violation of law is a type of violation of law or a cause of action. But deliberately dishonest, malicious, or fraudulent act is more specific, and that can be any type of act, Your Honor. It does not have to be a financial crime. And there's nothing, of course, in this language that connects it to a financial crime, if that's where I think Your Honor was asking.
Well, right, and in this context, this is D&O insurance. It would be a moral hazard to insure against this kind of conduct, and it would violate the fortuity principle that underlies all insurance contracts.
And that's correct, Your Honor. And it would also violate even in the GL context, whether it's an accident or an occurrence. But here, it's more specific than that, Your Honor. And with respect to the question that Judge Hamilton asked about, provided, however, this exclusion shall only apply if it's finally adjudicated that such conduct, in fact, occurred, that's an important provision, which says that if it's a mere allegation, it doesn't work to trigger this. But here we have the unusual situation of it's not a mere allegation. We had Larry Nassar convicted of a series of criminal offenses in two counties in Michigan. Some of those offenses dealt with USA Gymnastics athletes under 15 years old, others under 16 years old. These were not MSU students if they're 13 or 14 or 15. And there's no question that these are the same acts that USA Gymnastics is saying is the connection for all the investigations and for the white subpoena. And that includes the USOC investigations, the decertification, and the FBI investigation.
On that point of the provision, as we look at the various groupings of allegations, you've got the 10 that he pleaded guilty to, you got the additional 140 or 150, or you say 200 of individuals who spoke at the sentencing. Then there's a group of another 200 that are outside of that. Is your argument that those extra 200 are part of the final adjudication because they were Nassar related? Or is your argument that because they were all under these various investigations that they meet that provision?
It's that his acts as to the 10 for which he was convicted were also ended up including the other 140 or 200 who testified against him.
And what about that next group then of 150 or 200? Because I understood it to be a total of 400 or 450.
Yeah. All of them were complaining about the same acts, both the physical acts of abusing and molesting and digitally penetrating women and girls, as well as the cover up and the acts that he took to groom and prey on and perpetuate this crime. And he was convicted of all of that. And USAG has said that those are the acts that connect everything here. And to be clear, this is a $5 million directors and officers liability policy. If we're right and the panel agrees, it's a $250,000 policy with an EPL sublimit, but I won't spend time on that right now. But it has defense on top of that. And what USAG has said, because the panel or the Seventh Circuit asked us, what defense costs are going on out there when we originally invoked jurisdiction, because aren't the Nassar personal injury suits stayed? And for the most part, that's true, except the investigations are millions and millions of dollars of claimed costs, and they connect them to us because those investigations didn't start, with one exception I'll get to, until 2018, and our policy ended May 16th, 2017. The only way they connect all those investigations and the millions of dollars of claimed defense costs to us is through those same acts. Because those investigations, they admit, they claim, do not themselves involve sexual misconduct acts. In other words, USAG, if it's the subject of the investigation, or the USOC, or the FBI, or the white subpoena matter, is not itself claiming that they were harmed by a sexual crime. But USAG is connecting everything to the sexual crimes of Larry Nassar, Your Honor. And then the other, I'm sorry.
You may continue, I'm sorry.
Okay, the other issue that I just wanted to touch on is none of the cases that USAG cites involve this broad use of any. Under Indiana law and under the law essentially of every jurisdiction, any is distinguished from the. And USAG goes a long way to try to say that any shouldn't be simply distinguished from the, it should also be distinguished from all. The court doesn't need to go there. A plain language, fair and only reasonable reading is that any insured means any insured, not the insured. Their reading essentially wants to read out the any to say that the exclusion only applies with respect to Larry Nassar, even though it says the insured. And to be
could you help me because time is short, I'd like to move to the anti-imputation clause.
Yes.
Exclusion, and I'm struggling to understand it. What is the purpose of that clause?
Okay, sure. The anti-imputation clause says, for purposes of determining the applicability of the section we've been talking about as well as others, the wrongful act of any insured person shall not be imputed to any other insured person. And to be clear, that's distinguishing an insured person from an insured organization, Your Honor. And what that means is that if not Dr. Nassar, who's an insured person, and to be clear, an insured person must be a natural person, not a corporation. So if Dr. Nassar is convicted, but Ms. Smith is another employee of USAG, she is not precluded from having this insurance just because another insured person was. However, and this is our point, Your Honor, this doesn't say any other insured, which would include an insured organization. It doesn't say any other insured person or insured organization, which, by the way, other sections do say of this policy. This policy says that the only person who gets treated as if they're innocent and therefore gets coverage, regardless of whether another insured person doesn't, is another insured person. And somehow the district court read out insured person to mean insured organization. There is no law in Indiana or elsewhere that permits a reading of insured person to mean insured organization. And the argument instead that somehow we should have said explicitly in this situation that insured person means and not insured organization is not supported by any law. If I could spend 2 minutes, members of the panel, on the investigation issue, and if I and maybe save 1 minute for year of claim, and then I'll save some time for rebuttal with the panel's permission. Investigations, I mentioned the investigations in passing. Here too, we believe that the panel has the power and should reverse entirely. But in the event that the panel doesn't feel the record is sufficient to do so, then we should have an opportunity to develop the facts. And to be clear, there were two ways that LIU tried to develop the facts here. One was by pointing to the very same Ropes and Gray report that USA Gymnastics relied on. And when we did so, the bankruptcy court called the facts that were cited, quote, chatter. Chatter is a word I'm not familiar with under the federal rules, but the court used that to deny us an opportunity to either create a fact issue or to take discovery. The other issue is the Rule 56D affidavit. I just want to point out to the court that the FBI investigation is no more or less a claim than the USOC investigation with Ropes and Gray, a private law firm doing the work. Both of them were started by reach outs, actually USAC with just a letter from Ropes and Gray. And USAG insists that's a formal investigation, which is a requirement under the policy. The FBI investigation was actually started when various famous athletes complained of being physically molested by Dr. Nasser. The other issue I want to bring up just before I quit, because I don't want to use up all of my time unless the panel has questions, is the timing issue here, because it was another issue that we thought we were at least entitled to have discovery on and pointed to the Ropes and Gray report, among other things. There's no question, because USAG itself cites to the Ropes and Gray report to prove this, that the investigation by the FBI began in July and August 2015. Remember, our policy incepts May 16, 2016. And there were interviews that were conducted in September 2015. Again, in the same Ropes and Gray report that USAG cited and relied on. This was apparently called chatter. We believe that if it establishes that the actual FBI investigation was a formal claim and began with interviews of important and well-known athletes, and that resulted in an investigation by the FBI, then it precedes our policy period and does not trigger our policy. With the panel's permission, I'd like to reserve the remaining 3 minutes.
That's fine, thank you. Mr. Plews?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The first thing I want to say about this case is that it's about the duty to defend. And it is measured, duty to defend, measured under Indiana law. And Indiana law on the duty to defend is quite clear, and it is expansive and says that there is a duty to defend if there's any possibility of coverage here. And as I will think I will be able to show you, and we showed you in our briefs, there certainly is more than a possibility of coverage under for all of these various claims and investigations, as well as what they had been paying on already in terms of the 4 to 5% he mentioned about the bodily injury claims. The crucial part about this is that when you look at, for example, an exclusion under the Seymour case in Indiana, just simply having an exclusion that might apply isn't enough to block the duty to defend. By the way, Judge Hamilton, to answer your question, the first check we got was on October 28th of this year. And when you, so if you have a duty to defend, as they do, then it's unquestionably a duty to defend under the policy, then you have that duty, it continues until it's shown there is no possibility of coverage. And they haven't done that. And so the support for the court, and in 100 pages of briefing, they don't even mention Seymour or discuss the standard of a duty to defend or how that works. Their argument seems to be now, and the primary argument in the brief was that they had no opportunity for discovery. That's just about, and now they most vociferously complain about the FBI investigation in 2018, the FBI work in 2015. Yep, they've known about that since the very beginning of this claim. If you look at the letters in volumes 2 and 3 of the, particularly volume 3 of the appendix, you'll see that those letters articulate, there's a reservation of rights letters from them, articulate this very issue as early as July of 2016. They have had all the time, most importantly, since the time when we filed our motion for summary judgment in the adversary proceeding in front of Judge Moberly, that was on March 1st of 2019. They had 6.5 months to conduct whatever discovery they wanted to. With respect to that, to file a 56D motion if they needed more time, if they needed more information. But they didn't do that. And they didn't file that until, they didn't file a 56D motion until after we pointed out the absence of that and in support of objections after Judge Moberly had heard and ruled on the motion for summary judgment. And that's not good enough. That's a waiver. That's a waiver of And furthermore, you know, the question here is not a simple one between ordinary advocates. They're an insurance company. They've sold us a policy promising to defend us. They have a duty to investigate that claim as soon as they get it for whether or not they have a duty to defend. And here they are 4 years later from 2016 when we make our notice. We're now in 2020. 4 years later, claiming that they need more discovery and that it's inadequate to proceed without it, that somehow the judgment about a potential for coverage and therefore a duty to defend is somehow inadequate on that basis. And that just won't sell. In your own cases, Judge Hamilton, even the Smith case, where you found there was a basis to go back on a 50s to get some relief, there the party was diligently pursuing discovery, not letting it go for 4 years. And in other cases, Woods, in those cases, provide that the result is a waiver and a forfeiture, and that that's only their own fault. And certainly it is the case here. They haven't identified a single document. We haven't given them a single question. We haven't answered. They simply sat on this and have not done their due diligence to be able to mount a defense that they need more discovery and that somehow the judge's determination was premature or unfair to them. With respect to this new FBI investigation, I want to point something out that's very important. And that is, it doesn't really change anything. The policy provision that defines a claim is one thing. Then in that definition of 23.3, it continues on to say, and this is the critical point, because when it's deemed first made is what policy it triggers. And it says a claim will be deemed first made on the date an insured receives a written demand, complaint, indictment, notice of charges, or order of formal investigation. So to be first made and to trigger that policy, that's when a policy period is triggered. They have to show a written document. One of the five documents listed, which are written demand, complaint, indictment, notice of charges, or order of formal investigation. So the principal argument they now present actually doesn't make a difference as to whether, because they haven't been able to show any of those documents, written demand, written complaint, written indictment, written notice of charges, or written order of formal investigation. So there hasn't been a claim first made. And in fact, what the judge found is true. The claim was first made in May of 2016 when the first written demand was received. And that's all anybody, FBI, Ropes and Gray, well, I can't say LAU because I'm really conducting a discovery, but that's all they've been able to find. So,
and that, Mr. Flews, determination of the bankruptcy court was made on the basis of an affidavit from, was it the CFO of USA? Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
It was not based on any evidence of the underlying claim.
No, it was based in the appendix. You'll see the notice of the other claims, and you'll see that by July, they were informed by us of the earlier transmission of information to the FBI. They knew all that. And if you look at 644, 645, and appendix 644, you'll see that they have that. They have that information already.
Right. No, this is not related to the waiver question. This is, and the procedural question that's lurking underneath when the first claim was made. I'm looking for the substance of when the first claim was made and what the record tells us when the first claim was made. And all we have is the affidavit of the CFO. We don't have an actual claim document in the record.
Yes, you do. You have the claim itself, the May 25th, 2016 claim. You have the written documents in there.
In the record?
Yes, I believe it is. And you also have the Ropes and Gray report, which describes the same thing. I mean, everybody that's looked at this has come around to the same conclusion, and they don't have anything different. And they haven't even tried. They haven't even looked beyond that or asked us for it. There isn't anymore. And that's where we stand. Now, I will say to you that even if that were still an issue in some doubt and it had some relevance, because you see, because it's not a claim first, they don't have an earlier claim first made document. It has no real relevance here. But even if it did, that wouldn't be a basis for not defending. The duty to defend, and it doesn't matter how you label the policy, by the way, right, whether it's through D&O policy, the policy makes the promises it makes in plain English. And those promises are solemn ones, and they are to be obeyed, and they've been paid for. And so they need to provide for that. Now, I'd like to turn to the conduct exclusion, because that's an important exclusion. But here again, the first point to make is that the mere presence of an exclusion, even one that might work, doesn't defeat the duty to defend. And that's what you have before you. You don't have indemnity damages before you. You have a duty to defend before you. And you have what's the defense duty. But now let's look at this exclusion for a moment. The first thing you have to say is that it's got to be crystal clear under Indiana law, under Kiger and Flexstar and the other cases we've cited. You can't just have an exclusion. The exclusion has to be precise and specific and clear. And this isn't, for many reasons. But you look at the any, the double any's there, and you can easily confine that, as I did when I first read it, to the, talking about the person who actually committed the act. Any person that's not who commits this kind of act is not going to get coverage.
Mr. Plews, does the use of the double any's or the many any's and the double any insured take this case away from Frankenmuth and take it away from Holiday Hospitality?
Yeah. No, Your Honor, it doesn't. I don't think, because it doesn't. No, they never make an argument how the double any's do anything particularly. It just adds more confusion in my mind. If anything, the use of the two any's should be consistent between one any to two any. That's not the only indication we have here of the limitation of this policy, several of which you've pointed out already, in this limitation is exclusion. And they limit it by the adjudication requirement. It says final adjudication, finally adjudicated. And that is adjudication to a policyholder of ordinary intelligence, which is what the standard is in Indiana, means a certain thing. It means an adjudication, a solemn finding by a judge, not a guilty plea, not testimony at a sentencing hearing. It means what it says, an adjudication. They haven't shown you that any of those on the record, that those any of those 10 relate to USAG specifically. They just haven't shown that. It was their burden.
What about, Mr. Plews, that prefatory language in 4.9, based upon, arising from, or in any way related to? Does that broaden it from the 10?
No, Your Honor, it's based upon, arising from, related to. You can't say it related to in the sense of, if you look at the exclusion as a whole, you can't say that it's meant to pick up absolutely any connection whatsoever of anything, because it contains all those other provisions. It contains the final adjudication requirement and the non-imputation clause is another indication. And let me say another thing about this very point, and that is that LIU in six letters over 2 years in volume 3 of the record, I'll give you examples, A578 and A644-645, took the position that's exactly ours, that it would only bar intentional conduct by USAG, not have it be innocent conduct, if you will, merely neglectful conduct by USAG, be barred by that provision. That's a position they took, their lawyers, for the first six letters they wrote on this. And I'd submit that's pretty powerful evidence that this exclusion is not clearly the way they say it is. I don't see how you get it. They make the statements, and all that happens to change their mind is that we sue them.
So well, on its face, Mr. Plews, the anti-imputation clause does not refer to the organizational insured.
It doesn't. And so it doesn't really say one way or the other, does it? So then if you're a policyholder, what you might do, I'm sorry.
It's just not in play here.
No, it is in this sense. So I want to make one point about that, if I might, Your Honor. If you look at 6.2, which is later on in the policy, you'll see there that when they meant to impute liability to the insured organization, they said that. They used the word insured organization in that clause. It's a clause about imputing misstatements in an application. And you'll see that they use the word insured organization in that when they're talking about the imputation. if you're the policyholder of average intelligence, looking down, looking at this policy and seeing it, looking at that clause in conjunction with the failure to use insured organization in that clause, and then looking at the, not just the anti-imputation clause, but the final adjudication clause, and then the word any, you begin, the signals are that they're trying to protect the innocent insured. They're after all protecting the innocent person, right? The innocent insured person. And remember, our organization is only made up of people. I mean, it's so if they're going to specifically single out the insured organization, it needed to be set forth as they do in that paragraph just a little bit farther down the policy. And there's a case in Indiana, Flexstar, a Supreme Court case, that makes that very point. When an insurance company has language available, doesn't use precise language, that it's stuck with the ambiguity. And the ambiguity here is evidenced by a bunch of other things I wanted to touch on quickly. Besides their own recitation that it would be interpreted the way that we said it would be, they concede the possibility of coverage really by paying all those Nassar bodily injury claims, because if this conduct exclusion actually worked, they shouldn't have been paying the bodily injury claims either, right? It's the conduct exclusion applies to them too, but they didn't. They paid them because there's a possibility of coverage there. There's a disagreement among courts, as you know from the briefs. We have 7 state appellate courts in the 10th Circuit with us. And that dispute, that very dispute under the Dana and Summit cases in Indiana, is important evidence of the ambiguity of the provision, that judges being are presumed to be reasonable people, and therefore, you know, when they disagree about what the scope of an exclusion or a provision, that's sound evidence of ambiguity. In addition, the Indiana case law has touched on this kind of a clause, which we talked a little bit about earlier, Frankenmuth, Holiday Hospitality. The language, the best thing I can say about that is the most compelling thing, I think, is that when you lay those provisions by each other, the provisions in Holiday Hospitality, the provision in Frankenmuth, and in our policy, as the court did below, you find much greater similarity in the language between our policy and Frankenmuth than you do with either one with Holiday Hospitality. And that's because among other reasons, in Holiday Hospitality, the policy made it very clear that they were reaching the torts of negligent retention and supervision. In fact, they expressly barred them. So it's easy to make the construction consistent. Whereas in our case, as justices in the Frankenmuth case pointed out, and by the way, Frankenmuth, I've looked at the briefs. In Holiday Hospitality, Frankenmuth was just never mentioned. The lawyers on each side represented insurance companies. They weren't fighting about that issue. They were fighting about a care, custody, or control issue. That's what 90% of the opinion is about. And they never even mentioned Frankenmuth in 250 pages. Now, McGowan, a case we cited to you that certified this question to the Indiana Supreme Court, but then was settled before it got resolved, is another indication of the ambiguity of these and the sort of conflict in decisional law that we have here.
Was McGowan a D&O policy or a CGL policy?
I think it's GL policy, Your Honor.
Right. I think we have to pay attention to context because insurance policies are written in a contextualized way. And frankly, I don't think either of these cases, Holiday Hospitality or Frankenmuth, are very helpful here because they're a completely different kind of policy. This is D&O insurance. And I think we have to take into account the context for which this is being written when deciding what the scope of coverage is. That's very sound principle of insurance policy interpretation. And I don't think the Indiana courts disagree with that principle. So unless there's some D&O law in Indiana on a clean slate here, and I didn't see in the briefs much reference to D&O case law in Indiana. So we have to step back and take a little broader view, it seems to me, and look to principles of D&O insurance law that apply elsewhere, and maybe you can help with that. This language, Mr. Schiller tells us in response to my question, is common to D&O insurance. And so what does it mean in that context?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, in Indiana, I'm aware of no case that says D&O words in a D&O policy are to be treated differently than words in a CGL policy.
That's not necessary. We always consider the context of the contract. That's just the sound principle of insurance contract interpretation. We don't need a statement from the Indiana courts to tell us that. Auto policies are contextual, CGL policies are contextual, health insurance policies are contextual. That's just, principle. So I'm asking, in the D&O context, how have other courts and other jurisdictions interpreted this kind of very broad language?
I don't know of any court that has said a D&O case that has said, because it's a D&O policy, we're not covering this kind of claim.
Just humor me, okay? Let's assume that we have to interpret this in context. And right. Can you answer my question? Is there case law from other jurisdictions interpreting a D&O policy that uses similar sorts of words and phrases in writing an exclusion for intentional, willful, unlawful conduct?
I'm not aware of a case that does that specifically in a D&O context. What
do the treatises say?
The treatises, I don't think address that I'm aware of, and nobody cited any treatise to you in this case that says that the D&O policies are treated differently in that fashion. And I think that, Your Honor, well, some of the courts have recognized the claims made nature of D&O policies as opposed to CGL policies. That doesn't mean we don't look at the language or interpret the language somewhat differently. And I submit that for all the reasons that, including the courts that have wrestled with the language and the type of what they're all talking about, the same type of conduct. And this policy wasn't written, it could have been written to exclude all coverage for anything having to do with a whole bunch of things, but if their words aren't there, we can't simply draw them from a context that doesn't exist.
Well, to your point, claims made insurance functions very differently from occurrence-based insurance.
Oh, I'm sure.
There's both forms of liability insurance, but they operate and function very differently, and insured contract differently for that different kind of coverage.
Right. Oh, I understand that, but I think we fit very easily with the claims first made and all the other provisions of this policy. This policy is somewhat different than other D&O policies in the very area of claims, what it defines as a claim and how it defines claim, which is another issue on appeal here. Our definition has a much broader and much less limited content than other D&O policies in there. That's an area where there's been more litigation and more. But for example, the Muscle Farm and National Stock Exchange cases, in National Stock Exchange, they needed for a claim to have a formal investigation. It was a strictly limited to investigations initiated by certain documents. The claim here, in contrast, does not require that. It does not require the initiation by a written document. It says the duty to defend is to defend any claim. And the claim here includes the commencement of a formal regulatory proceeding or investigation, including blah, blah, blah. And that's, it's any formal investigation. It doesn't require a specific document. Those other policies, for example, Muscle Farm, didn't cover investigations. It only covered proceedings. And when it covered investigation it covered was that pursuant to a Wells notice, a particular kind of notice in SEC investigation. That's not the case here. This is these terms are broad. And when you look at those terms, investigation and formal, and you're trying to decide, does it cover what happened here? Indiana law provides the analogy, I think, in the Dana and Summit cases, which they don't address, that are cases where they looked at the word suit, which was similarly undefined, and said, what would the policyholder of ordinary intelligence think about that and how would it resolve that? And it looked at it just as a policyholder would look here, where they have the duty to defend a claim, which is broadly defined. Policyholder would look at that and say, I have defense coverage. I am entitled to be defended, because formal investigation doesn't, the way it's used here and the way it is as an undefined term considered under Indiana law, you look at it from that standpoint. How would the policyholder interpret that? And they'd look at that and say, the investigations of the sort we have here are certainly the kinds of investigations that this policy has in mind. This is a gap.
Mr. Clues?
Okay.
Clues, I don't know. I know everybody has a lot to say here, and I don't want to interrupt another line of questioning if it's not done.
No, go ahead.
But there are two things I'd like to make sure that you address before you wrap up. One is the issue of the third-party EPL limits, in particular, because given the objective history, not the subjective intent about what we meant that Liberty has offered, but objective history of the party's relationship and negotiations, I have real trouble with the notion that that parole evidence was not allowed to explain what was meant by that coverage that was in, that was out, and that came back in with a limit. Second issue I'd like you to address is Mr. Schiller's point in suggesting that USAG is inconsistent in the way that it treats the issue of relatedness among the different claims.
Okay. Thank you, Aaron. First, on the limits side of things and how that works, remember that there's a letter, October of 2018, where they confirmed that they deleted that coverage from the policy. So there's no question that deleted the coverage from the policy, and that the limit that hung on there was simply an artifact. What they want to do, I think, I actually can't, it's not entirely certain, they want to bring back into the policy some unspecified language of terms. And that's the problem. How do you do that? I mean, they deleted it deliberately and intentionally, and yet now they like the limit because that, from the perspective of today, it looks better for them, but there's no content to bring in. And this Lilly case makes it very clear that parties' prior course of dealing can't be used to try to explain an ambiguity or a lack of content in an insurance policy. And Dana doesn't change that. Dana was a different, Dana, by the way, is written by Justice Bohm, who, as you may know, also was the lead lawyer for Lilly in the Lilly case. So he knows there's a relationship between that. What he wrote, what he had in Dana was a factual dispute about how a policy premium was actually set. And that's what they had to deal with.
Now, the second point is about the relatedness.
Relatedness, right. I don't think we're inconsistent. I mean, we're trying to satisfy, to find which policy period the claims fit into. And then the relatedness of the claims for purposes of I think what you must be asking for is for purposes of the final adjudication provision
Conduct exclusion more generally.
Conduct exclusion generally. Okay. Is relatedness there? It requires prior adjudication of such conduct or final adjudication of such conduct. And I'm not sure the purpose of the relatedness provision that you've been talking about earlier is to figure out which claims get sorted between which policies. And that's not what the purpose of the conduct exclusion is. It needs to be the kind of relatedness that is the 10. I mean, those are the 10. They have to show the relation between that and the other insurer, in this case, USHA.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aris.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Schiller, you have some time. Oh, you're still muted, Mr. Schiller.
I apologize. Thank you. On the last question, this is what Allstate versus Dana, which Dana 2, it's the 2001 Indiana Supreme Court decision, said 16 years after Eli Lilly, evidence of industry practice is admissible to construe terms of art or ambiguous agreements. On the other issues, I want to be clear that we also just heard a contradiction by USAG about what commences an investigation. What we heard is that using the last terms of the language on the commencement of an investigation, that it has to be an order of formal investigation. Yet on footnote 5 of USAG's brief, they said it didn't have to be an order of formal investigation. And although USAG just argued that it had to be an order of formal investigation, later you heard that it doesn't have to be an order of formal investigation. Our point in my argument, Your Honors, is that you had two U.S. Olympic Committee investigations. One was a decertification proceeding, and the other was their massive investigation through the private law firm Ropes and Gray. These were not started with subpoenas, orders of investigations, or any other compulsory process. These were started by Ropes and Gray sending letters and saying, we want to talk to you. They are seeking millions of dollars for that USOC investigation, which didn't occur until 2018, nearly 2 years after our policy. The only way they can is by saying that they're formal investigations and relate back to Larry Nassar's conduct. At the same time, the FBI investigation, where the CEO of USAG in the summer of 2015 reached out to the FBI because he had complaints from USAG gymnastics famous athletes that they had been abused. And he set up interviews, including an interview in September that the FBI, according again to that same Ropes and Gray report that USAG relies on and put into evidence, said that they had used it to commence a formal investigation. So how can you have one? They're in the horns of a dilemma. One is a formal investigation, actually two USOC ones are, but the FBI one is not. Our point, Your Honor, is it wasn't 4 years or 6 years. We had reserved rights. We agreed to defend because you are permitted under the law of Indiana to defend while reserving rights. You are permitted to reserve generally. You do not waive when you reserve generally. There's no estoppel or waiver argument under Indiana law that is asserted here or works. We defended so that we wouldn't be accused of having given up our rights to assert these very defenses. There are fact issues here. They were asserted in opposing their motion for summary judgment as to the date of claim and other issues. We weren't given a chance to do anything about them and then raised the 56D affidavit on our objections. The 56D affidavit on our objections preserved again the issues, and in no case cited for waiver or estoppel deals with a 56D affidavit and the bankruptcy court jurisdiction and authority, and provides that the bankruptcy court can deny that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Is it your theory, Mr. Schiller, that in an adversary proceeding in the bankruptcy court, a party is entitled to basically fully litigate the summary judgment motion and then pull out a 56D motion for the first time in a do-over in the district court?
Cannot raise new issues, Your Honor, but can raise factual issues. Well, yeah, evidentiary.
Your theory is that summary judgment in the bankruptcy court you're entitled to an entire do-over in the district court.
That you are entitled to present additional evidence, Your Honor, under 93. Under 9033, yes, Your Honor.
Entitled, or that the court may entertain it?
Under the first line of the statute, that the word is shall. But more important, Your Honor, even though the court may bristle a district court judge at shall requiring him or her to consider additional evidence, no court has denied a 56D affidavit under these circumstances. This is not.
Has any court granted such a motion in a reported opinion?
I don't think there are any opinions dealing with this. What we contended, Your Honor, in our briefing, as Your Honor knows, is that it was an abuse of discretion to not even consider it. The court struck it on USAG's motion that they shouldn't even allow us leave to present a 56D affidavit. There is no court that's ever done that. We couldn't find one that even considered it, Your Honor. And the denial of discretion at all is an abuse of discretion, regardless of of the statute, which we believe stands for the proposition that additional evidence can come in, and some additional evidence come in. And in addition, as Your Honor went to it, the Ropes and Gray report and other things that were pointed to that USAG itself put into evidence and used to establish things like the White subpoena matter and when it was presented. And in answer to the Chief Judge's question, there is no evidence that the CFO went back and actually canvassed what prior claims they have. All we have is the CFO saying, this is the first one. We rate.
Thank you, sir. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement, and our thanks.